Okie doke. Right, we're off.
Right, I'm going to move over here. Ah. Oh, this is a different perspective for a change. I normally sit on the other side.
Okay.
Right, we're in the in Bamford this afternoon. This is another podcast, and we're at the Adventure Hub with Jeremy Windsor and me.
Hello.
Hello. Fancy meeting you here. Jeremy and I have history, but nevertheless, I'm going to try and do a little bit less talking and introduce the idea. So, Jeremy, over to you.
So, well, I'm an anaesthetist and critical care specialist at Chesterfield Royal. For the last 3 or 4 years, I've been involved in the Mountain Medicine Society, the British Mountain Medicine Society, and I'm a custodian of that. I suppose over the last 4 or 5 years, I've been trying to get mountain medicine onto a firmer footing. I suppose you'd say it's a niche specialism of medicine, but it's becoming realised over the last few years how important it is. There was a report published a couple of years ago. Oh, I can't remember its title. It was The Outdoor Client, I think it was called, by Sport England. And what they did was that they interviewed a large group of people looking at how involved they were in the outdoors, and it's quite clear that there's something like 9 million people in England who are regularly using the outdoors.
A significant part.
So a large number of people. Many of them are going to mountains. But what was really interesting from a mountain medicine point of view is that 9 million people were an older group in the main, people aged 40, 50, 60, 70, with medical problems. Many of whom were using the outdoors to help treat their medical problems.
Yeah.
So, you know, you think of high blood pressure and diabetes and osteoporosis and all these illnesses that we face as we get older. People recognising that they could be treated by going out in the outdoors, climbing, walking, scrambling, cycling, doing what they will. But they also recognised that those illnesses also were holding people back from using the outdoors. So as mountain medical people, we've got a job, I think, in the future to encourage those people to exercise in a safe and successful way.
Okay.
And many of the courses that we've run over the last few years are really focusing on that, on how to get people doing more outdoors and living a healthier life. And I think it's worked quite well. We've done... What have we done?
When you say we, I mean, I go in the outdoors.
Mm.
Who am I relying on if I have to?
Well, it's a whole network, isn't it?
Right.
And from our point of view, we've got people coming to our courses who are involved in mountain rescue teams.
Okay.
We've got paramedics and first responders. We've got GPs who regularly prescribe exercise. We've got hospital doctors who treat the complications and side effects and injuries of being out in the mountains. So people who are providing that safety net, I guess, to those who do go in the outdoors and try and encourage people to do more safely.
Right, okay. Well, we have similar sort of backgrounds, I guess, in terms of outdoors.
Mm.
I never consciously think I've got all that support network behind me.
Hmm.
I'm probably typical, reckless, until the point that I suddenly require it. I've had a couple of instances, which I've directly example, where we've got ambulances and things like that. But I'm not conscious of necessarily when I would use those, how it would happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd counter that and say, I mean, for instance, working here with the guys at the Adventure Hub, who are, you know, seeing upwards of 1,000 people coming through their facility every year.
Okay.
Many of whom have medical problems. Many of whom fill in medical forms, questionnaires. They all have a medical input as such. They see their GP to check whether they can go out into the mountains, go out into the hills. They buy equipment and they're fitted with clothing and safety apparatus that has gone through some form of medical appraisal, if you like.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, although it's seemingly remote to an extent, medicine plays a part in all that, from the boots people wear to the plasters that they put on their corns. there's medicine floating around there in the ether. I suppose it's even more demonstrable when people go on big events, either in the UK, so there's been the huge explosion in ultra marathons, long distance events, sportifs, those all have medical support, to folks who want to take their skills that they've picked up in the UK and go abroad. So it may be guys who want to do a trek to Everest Base Camp, or they want to go to Kilimanjaro, or they want to do the Machu Picchu Trail, or they want to do something. They'll all go through companies in the UK and go through a whole medical process of assessment before they're finally signed up and are on the plane to their destination. So there is a process there.
So if I was, let's say I want to go on an expedition as an individual. My experience says that I've kind of tick a lot of the boxes. I know what to expect and know what to do, and I go there with a plan. But I don't build in an expedition doctor, for example, to those.
No.
So how would you know? Do when you say that carries on? So I mean, if I was in the Alps, for example. And is there an equivalent sort of thing then, or would?
So in the UK, one of the important reasons behind setting up the British Mountain Medicine Society a couple of years ago was to provide a framework and support for people who do that job of assessing and helping people who do want to join expeditions. So for instance, if you were going to go to Kilimanjaro, you would fill in a medical form, tick box exercise really, but for most of us, but for a lot of people there'll be a long list of chronic medical problems that are worth discussing and worth acting upon. And what our members in the Mountain Medicine Society do often is that they will go through these questionnaires and then give feedback to expedition companies and the clients to try and tailor perhaps what expedition is best for them, or to try when they're on that expedition to make it as safe and successful as possible. I mean, the common sort of problems that we encounter are people with type 2 diabetes wanting to go on expeditions, people with chronic musculoskeletal problems, bad backs, bad knees. We see people with obstructive sleep apnea who want to take their breathing machine with them to Kilimanjaro. We see a host of different things that can be optimised, improved in order to help them on the mountains. I had a chap just recently who had a condition called ulcerative colitis. That's a bowel condition. It can be a fatal condition. It affects upwards of 100,000 people in the UK, but it's characterised with lots of episodes of bloody diarrhoea and abdominal pain. And a chap approached us through the blog that you've helped us publish, but he got in touch wanting to go to Kilimanjaro, wanting advice on how he could best manage his ulcerative colitis whilst he was away. So I was able to speak to a gastroenterologist who I knew, who was very keen on the mountains and done a lot of expeditions, and he gave us some advice on how best to treat him. So this chap who was in touch with us had, I think he was only in his 30s, but had spent several years in hospital intermittently with complications from his bowel disorder, and had been started a few years ago on a drug called infliximab. A very expensive, very effective drug which has transformed, is revolutionising inflammatory bowel disease treatment. It's given as an infusion every 4 or 5 weeks, and for him it had turned his life around. From someone who needed multiple operations throughout his 20s to the point where he wasn't able to work, was largely housebound for large periods of time. He'd started on this treatment and within a year had got into walking, had walked the Pennine Way, had done 50 Munros over the course of the previous year, much due to the fact that this treatment that he was on, infliximab, had turned his life around. And as a result, after you've done that sort of thing, he was looking for the next challenge, and it was Kilimanjaro for him. So he wanted to know how best he could manage his condition with the drugs that he was receiving and still make a success at Kilimanjaro. And he was. And that's what the British Mountain Medicine Society does. It offers support to people with those sort of medical conditions and many others besides, and helps them achieve ambitions.
It's you know, thankfully, I haven't suffered too many medical issues, so I've done the outdoors without that. But this is making it much more inclusive as an outdoors, or whatever it might be, whether it be mountaineering, running, rather than being exclusive.
Yeah,
I mean, I probably in the past have been accused of being a bit elitist, you know, things, you know, you do what you do because you can, not because you're trying to make it available. I was introduced recently to disabled sailing. You know, the first question is why, because, you know, it never really occurred to me. You know, we did it at a level, I sailed at a level which you just, you know, you expected all your physical, everything to be in, you know, that's what you worked for. But when I saw how much enjoyment and how much you could get by just putting somebody who didn't have that and all the things that it entails that can make it happen, it was quite an eye-opener. So all that support.
And this is seen right across the board now. You've got walking football, walking netball. You're seeing more people walking in the outdoors than ever before. We've got e-bikes.
Isn't it funny how that's happened, though? This is just created... I mean, I'm the world's worst. I would have come in and said, you know, what the hell do you need? You know, an e-bike. Mm. But when I see it, apart from the fact that they overtake you when you're trying very hard to go up a hill or something, it's opened up a whole new world to a much bigger audience. Yes,
and speak to James just a few doors down to us, who hires e-bikes.
Oh, does
he'll,
he now?
Yeah, right, he'll talk about how transformative an e-bike is, and he's having customers now who he would never have seen before in their 50s, 60s and 70s, very little history in the outdoors, are coming to him for the first time because the e-bike offers them potential to get out and see the people street.
I saw the first e-mountain bike on at Lady Canning's just a few weeks ago. And I thought, why would you want to do that? But he was buzzing up there.
Yeah.
I mean, the big joke when you run is that you can outrun mountain bikers uphill. But no, I couldn't this time. Suddenly I discovered what's going on. And you know, so it was the Nike, you know, the old idea of Telefariques and then charge down.
And so from the mountain medicine perspective, what's really interesting now is that mountain medicine 10 or 20 years ago catered for the elite athlete.
Yes.
But now that has changed, it's transformed. Now we've got people who, through the aid of e-bikes and other technologies, are going into the mountains for the first time, would never have done before, but are going with a host of chronic medical problems.
Right. So they're not thinking that they can't.
We've been told that sport for all, that people can get out there and do things. And they should be able to do that. We should be able to do that. But what we have to do from a medical point of view is accept that and then provide the safety nets for those people in those environments.
Right.
I mean, a really good example recently has been we saw, I had a contact from a group of elderly women who in their 70s and 80s who were worried about their osteoporosis and worried about whether or not they would be safe hiking
the hills
around in the Peak District.
All right, excellent.
And it was a very real question because I think they'd been out on one trip and one of their friends had fallen and broken their hip. And so I had this email from a leader saying, well, look, you know, what can we do about this? And of course, there are things that can be done. People can have their bone densities assessed, and they can be stratified and given a risk of potential fracture. And that's very easy to do.
These people have been pre-diagnosed as having a condition like osteoporosis, or is it something that, say, I now, at a certain age, would go and have a scan?
Yes, there's an age cutoff now,
And
it's different for men and women. Primary care, so that is the general practice, won't necessarily reach out and do that for people.
No.
It needs people to go to them and say, look, I'm doing these activities now that potentially put me at risk of fall, but I'm also doing this activity because I want to strengthen my bones and prevent osteoporosis. So I recognise that this is a treatment from osteoporosis, but it comes at a risk. So can you tell me what my risk is of developing a fracture if I fall, and directing me with treatment and advice from that? And from a mountain medicine perspective, we can facilitate that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's almost a win-win, isn't it? You know, where people suddenly realise that there's no limits to what they can do despite a condition or whatever it might be. Yeah. And it certainly opens, you know, we live in the Peak District and so on, that each weekend that increase has gone exponential. Yeah. I think in the last 5 years, you know, we've gone from... It's interesting because I've moved through various physical activities. My group of runners are now cyclists who occasionally run.
Yeah.
Well, you go into now because of a conditions, or they can't run as well as they wanted to, and the cycling has become a more prevalent. Well,
running is a really good example, because 2 years ago we set up a night race in Hathersage.
Oh, yeah.
So it runs in November each year. We get between 80 and 120 runners, and it's run in November. It starts at 6:30, so it is done completely in the dark. And it's quite a unique event on the Fell Running Association calendar.
It is on the FRA now.
It's on the FRA calendar, there are night events, but most of them are team events.
Yeah.
So this is a solo event. It's a 5-mile run. And the feedback we've had from it has been just brilliant. After the first year, a woman got in touch saying, I had never been out running in the dark before.
Mm.
You know, I didn't realise that a head torch would allow me the freedom to go and run outdoors. And because of going out running in the dark and the fear that that instilled, I didn't go out and run at night. But I met friends through the night race. We've started to go outside. And now we take our head torches and we go out once a week and run at night during the winter.
Yeah.
And so those, you realise that there are limitations that we have upon ourselves. But there are ways to break through those limitations. And organising events like a night race facilitates that. Yeah. It allows people to do something different.
I mean, I'm smiling here because I've run on head torches for years. But we had these little orange glows that illuminated something, which, you know, they were virtually useless back 10, 15, 20 years ago. Nowadays, with LEDs and the, you know, the lumens that they have, it's like running in daylight.
Yeah. Well, it's an example, isn't it, of how technology can be harnessed to improve opportunities. And another example of that is the advent of swimming wetsuits.
Yeah.
So now we can swim in a 3.5 or 4 mil wetsuit in conditions that before we could never have gone on in our swimming costumes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we can swim now in water that's 10 to 15 around. Degrees, where before we rarely got in water below 15 degrees.
Why would you do that?
Yeah, yeah. But you can spend an hour now in 15 degree water and not feel the effect of it. And a lot of people swim in a lot colder water. And unlike the old wetsuits that were 8 and 9 mil, and they were impossible to swim in.
Well, you couldn't move in them.
Yeah, you couldn't move in them. A 3.5 mil wetsuit just gives you such great freedom of movement that you can...
Well,
achieve
the big thing I've... some people will know by background, but it's the sailing wetsuits. Went for you and you cut them out and glued them together, and they came out like a suit of armour. They were useless. They were absolutely useless.
Yeah.
But it got us out sailing and they got the sowed the seed.
Yeah.
Then, this is a long time ago, 90s, I think, when I discovered new Japanese neoprene, which is the 3 mils and 2 mils and stuff. And we brought that into this country and we made our wet, so I've got people to make up the gals of this world. Mm-hmm. And O'Neill's and things, and made these suits, and we didn't want to take them off, because it was just made winter sailing fun.
That's good, yeah.
And but the thought was the worst rather than the deed.
Yeah, you know. But the technology has done that, hasn't it?
Yeah,
so,
exactly. Yeah.
So the 3 mil wetsuit, the head torch, all these technologies just provide opportunities.
Merino, proper merino wool, lightweight merino wool. I mean, the original merino was quite uncomfortable, but flat weaving. You know, and properly spun, and suddenly you're in a different world.
Yeah,
again.
And the recognition of going more lightweight.
Yes.
I mean, that has really improved cycle touring.
Yeah. You know,
and Alpkit have got a good example of that, haven't they? The kit that's now available for cycle touring just means that people can travel with a very small shelter, simple kit, just one or two panniers, and can be out there exploring. So
and go major distances.
Yeah, like technology and experience have allowed us those opportunities.
Well, you see, we've been talking about various bits and pieces over the months and since the death zone. When I talk about some of the blogs that we've put up, the death zone always comes up. What the hell's all that about? Literally, that's what they say.
Yeah.
And even medics would connect the thing, but you say, well, why is, it's, we just, and it's that sort of awareness of all these other things that are going on.
Yeah.
And introducing sort of science. Now, I'm a scientist, I think. I am, but that's where your background.
Yeah.
So it's intriguing when you bring all this technology, which whether it be digital, whether it be physical, manual, these electric bikes and so on. So what, the one thing we mentioned was your part of the Mountain Medicine on the thing was the Science Day,
mm-hmm.
which is coming up when?
So that's coming up on the 13th of November.
Right.
So that stems from other courses that we've run over the last 2 or 3 years, all through the Mountain Medicine Society. That's a one-day course that's going to take place in Bamford at the Institute there.
And who's that open to?
That's open to everybody.
So anybody can come along?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. It's open to all. We've got speakers talking about a whole range of subjects. So we've got folks from Bangor and Leeds and Edinburgh talking about the research that they've done on the brain, on the heart, on the bowels of people at high altitude.
You seem obsessed by the bowels.
Never forget the bowels. No, no. So right, I got okay, those. But then we've got folks from Mountain Rescue are talking about the science and technology that's gone into recent changes in mountain rescue techniques and training. We've got a fascinating talk from a guy from Edinburgh, Steve, who's spent several years on Peak Lenin. Now, Peak Lenin is on the Kyrgyzstan-Turkestan border, I think.
Right, it's a
7,000 meter peak. It's a,
what you mean to be exclusively climbing on
there? He's been there, I think, 2 or 3 seasons now, looking at different safety and issues on the mountain, and uses that those sort of lessons learned from that translate to safety and success in other mountain areas. But his experience in the former Russian republics, Soviet republics, will be, I think, really fascinating to hear. We've also got a talk from Chris Smith. Chris developed a fantastic booklet. She edited a booklet that's free to download called Travel at High Altitude, and it must have been downloaded now tens of thousands of times. It's been translated into almost 20 languages and is a simple 30 or so page booklet describing pretty much all the things you would encounter from a health perspective at high altitude. Right. And written for the layman, as I say, translated into many countries. It took a long time to put together, but now it's out there, free to download. Is being hailed as a real tool that's probably improved mountain safety.
So that you would put it down to significant changes.
Yeah.
Or is it like down to being the simple messages?
Simple message, small booklet, free to download, widely available, edited by a non-medic. Right, so she has taken, I was involved in writing the original one. I think she contacted at least 10 or 20 medical writers, and she took all the stuff we sent her and edited and paraphrased it down to being something very digestible.
Right.
And
so what was that called again? I already forgot.
Travel at High Altitude.
Travel at High Altitude, right,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Free to download through MedEx, M-E-D-E-X.
Okay.
And she's going to come and talk about how that project has evolved over the years.
Yeah.
So we've got that, and then we've got just lots of... It's interesting. When you organise a science day, you're doing it for two reasons, I think. On the one hand, you want people to come along and see what new science is out there and how it's being applied to the mountains. But also, I think this is, for me, a really interesting reason for doing it, is that it gives a great opportunity for young researchers. So they're the guys who are doing their PhD projects, who are doing the research now. It gives them an opportunity to come and present to an audience of laymen their ideas and and respond to questions.
Okay.
And stand up.
This wouldn't necessarily be medic, though, would it?
No, these PhD students are scientists in the main. They're not necessarily doctors, but they're all in the first stages of their postgraduate training.
Right.
So they're all BSc, BA holders, have all enrolled on PhD projects, run through places like Bangor University, which have a very good outdoor education background, a large high-altitude research department. Leeds Beckett as well, run by a guy called John O'Hara, very involved in high-altitude research.
Right.
But it gives those guys a chance to come present their findings and discuss them with interested members of the audience. And for them, it is a really important process in their postgraduate training.
Right. So this is a one-off opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So from my point of view, that's great. That's brilliant. But the ongoing, there was a but in there, I didn't mean to say it at the end, the ongoing, how do we learn from it? You know, the wider audience we've got, the technology allows.
Yeah,
there's plenty of people who will not be able to get there.
Yeah,
and
sure.
You know, how do we share that? What can we curate some of that stuff? I mean, how do you plan, or is there any planning in that?
Already through the blog, the Surviving the Death Zone blog, we've interviewed a number of the contributors for it, and those interviews will be going up around the time of the launch, and they'll be there as a resource for people to tap into at a later stage.
Excellent.
So that will be there. I also hope, though, that several of those speakers will also come and present regularly in the Peak District to larger audiences. So we're planning next June to have a Hathersage Mountain Medicine Festival, which builds on two previous events that we had in Hathersage last year and 2 years previously. And the last event attracted nearly 200 people along to it. That's a two-day festival in June. So I'm hoping that those speakers will also then have a chance to be involved with a larger audience as well.
Yeah, it's. I never cease to be amazed, but you know, people will take on new challenges and new thoughts and everything else. But in some ways, it has to be in their faces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say on your phone.
Yeah.
Can you see, is it accessible? That sort of ideas, and there is so much out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a matter of how do you assimilate all that.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, they've already taken on board, you know, high altitude, you know, sort of traveling at high altitude. That sounds like something I would maybe pick up on.
Mm.
But then on the other hand, I spend half the time at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I wouldn't necessarily be relevant, but it would link in
with
on a festival like that. You would have. I can see that how that might work, and rather than being prescriptive, you know, you get people. So they kind of a way we're hoping that these blogs and these podcasts and these things sort of kind of have a like tendrils. Mm. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Out there, and it brings in, you know, your sphere, and still accessible to some. You know, some people maybe wouldn't even dream of getting on this. It's.
I mean, that's the lesson I've certainly learned from blogging. I mean,
yeah.
I remember you sitting me down nearly 2 years ago and gave me a crash course on how to write a blog, and I took some of that on board. And I'm still learning and embracing it now.
Right.
But the blog was originally set up to try and encourage what we were doing in Chesterfield where I work. So we've set up a mountain medicine fellowship. So that's a two-year training scheme that appeals to junior doctors who are interested in completing what is the diploma in mountain medicine.
Right.
So it's a two-year post. They work for 2 years in the NHS as full-time doctors in critical care and anaesthetics, and we pay for them to complete the mountain medicine diploma, which is run through the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. And they have 4 one-week residential courses which we support, and over the course of 2 years they complete that diploma.
Those residentials, some of them are in the Peak District, or is that
Are at Plasy Brenin in North Wales, one is in Scotland, and the final week is an assessment in Arola in the Alps.
Oh right.
So it's
why not the Peak District? Is that just historical?
Or? Historically, we've always used the National Mountaineering Centre in Plaza Brennan. So, and that's worked very well for us in the past. But yeah, all of our courses that we've done since have been in the Peak District. So once people have that diploma, and now in the UK there are probably 250 or 300 diploma holders, there's still an appetite for ongoing medical education. That's where the courses that we ran in the last 4 years have really come into their own. And as I say, we've had nearly 200 people attending these courses. And I suppose really what we're doing on these courses is probably teaching the teachers. Yes. So the people who come to our Hathersage courses are people with some knowledge of mountain medicine, and they are probably, and most of them are active in actually passing on that knowledge. They're either guides, members of mountain rescue teams, they're doctors, they're paramedics, other healthcare professionals who've all got an interest already, and we're teaching the teachers, we're passing on more information to them, and hoping, as you say, with those tendrils, is that that information is then spreading out even further.
It is interesting that you went through the list of, you know, who they are, what they are, but I think, does it all come under the idea of enthusiast?
For sure.
That's what excites me. You've got people coming in here and they're enthusiastic and they learn and they want to learn and they want to part. It's not a hardship.
No.
And so the ease of how we can, as it were, pass that information on.
Yeah.
And getting, I mean, you know, everybody has to, I won't say everybody has to learn, that's not true, but it's because they want to.
Yeah, and they're a brilliant audience.
Yeah.
And it's taken several courses for me to learn how I think is best to communicate with them. The days of the long lecture have long gone. So the idea of sitting
in the background,
there for 50 minutes listening to one speaker go through 100 plus slides on a carousel, those days have gone. What we've concentrated on have been short 20-minute presentations. Yeah. And giving plenty of time for questions, because you know that in our audience there's an awful lot of knowledge and you ignore it at your peril, because I think as an organizer of these events, what you really get is two things. You get the presentation, but you get that brilliant 10-minute discussion after the presentation and that is really priceless. And the other thing that we've learned well is that debates are really good.
Right.
So we've set people up to debate subjects, and that brings the house down. Mm. We had a lovely debate last year between two of our junior colleagues. They were prepped well in advance, and they both took two sides of an argument. We had a young teenage girl, she must have been 12 or 13, we created a scenario, and 12 or 13 year old went to Kilimanjaro, developed symptoms of acute mountain sickness, and the debate was, someone so young, should we give them drugs to try and improve her acclimatization?
Right.
Should we give her drugs to improve her performance?
And
the debate probably only took 20 minutes, but we had 40 minutes of discussion. Everybody wanted to add something. And it created such colour and vibrancy. It was a fascinating hour, and all sparked by this debate. And we voted beforehand who would give drugs and who wouldn't. And then we voted again at the end and see if anybody changed their mind. Well, the audience had changed completely.
Had they? So you had a different aspect.
We had people lots of people voted to give her drugs. Everything will be fine. Give her drugs. But the debate brought out such nuance and such interest that everybody had changed their mind at the end of it. So the vote had changed completely.
So let's going back to the science day, for example. Yeah. Are you recording any of these things? Or are you planning, or can we? Or
well,
will
I think
it work?
It would be a lovely idea to do that, yes.
Make it as simple as possible. I mean, we're sat in a van and sat here recording. I mean, it's simple. One of the interesting things about the podcast is we're not pretending that we're BBC studio stuff.
No.
But it's never been an issue. And in fact, people are more wanting to listening. They maybe have to listen a bit harder, possibly. Yeah. It's not quite so as comfortable, you know. Some, like we just said a few minutes ago, a van turns up or something. Yeah. I feel that there's an opportunity not to be missed there, even if it's a an experiment to start off with.
The downside, I think, with a study date is that it's such a visual medium.
Ah, okay.
Every presenter is going to come armed with PowerPoint slides, and there'll be a lot of reference to a visual medium.
Well, what about, but taking on your point about the debate, I mean, couldn't we do that?
Well, I think,
because you can put up PowerPoint slides.
Yes, I mean, for next June, I've already come up with debates and ideas. One debate I want to have, mm-hmm. which I think will be really interesting. We're going to have a day dedicated to health in the Himalayas.
Okay.
So we're going to, because so many people are involved in going to Nepal and other countries, and you know, medicine is important out there at altitude in remote environments. But I'd like to have a debate that, for the first time in our meetings, embraces climate change. So what I really want to do is have a debate on whether people should even go to Nepal again.
This is getting intriguing. We could spend another month on this.
Yeah.
But right, okay.
But you know, from a mountain medicine point of view, we have been guilty in the past of jumping on planes and disappearing off to weird and wonderful places. But actually, I think we as a medical subspecialty have to give some thought to climate change and the impact of our actions upon the planet. So having a debate about whether we should even go to the Himalayas is, I think, a fascinating one. And to get two enthusiastic debaters to start the process off and debate for 10 or 20 minutes and then open it up to the audience.
Yeah, wow.
I'm going to be really interested to hear that, because what I've heard very recently from a lot of older mountain medics who are embracing climate change mm-hmm. is them arguing a case for, we shouldn't go to the Himalayas. We should focus at home. We should concentrate on activities close to home. Mm. We should be more carbon neutral. We should take a more active approach. But what I haven't heard yet are the young voices.
No, well, I'm just about to say.
Are the 20 and 30 somethings who've read about the Himalayas and are desperate to go and see it for themselves.
Yeah.
Why should they be penalised?
Absolutely, they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But then what can they bring?
Yes.
To that, which is different to one of the old days where you just crashed around the in some DC-3 in the Himalayas.
That's right. So I want to hear from them and see what their stories are, what their feelings are. A fascinating debate for next June when we have our Himalaya Day.
Right, there you go. Now, I'm going to wind this up because we go on. You and I have a terrible habit of going way over.
Yes.
It's about 40 minutes,
oh,
I think.
Dear,
so are you on time on that? Let me get round here, then I'll switch it off. So that was Jeremy. It's even stopped here. So what are we doing? Right, 37 minutes. That wasn't far off. I'm going to stop it. Thanks anyway. That was great.
You.
And there will be other episodes, obviously, from that conversation. So let's